On this episode of The Inside Kids, we talk to Associate Professor of Sculpture, Will Kanings.
That rhythm.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
This is a big, I mean, that's huge.
It is.
How
I think it's huge.
Well, I mean, I've been through that airport many a time, and it's, what is the foot traffic like?
Well, when my eldest daughter found out, she's at UT, and the first thing she looked up was how many people. And last year during the pandemic, it was 6.5 million. So I can imagine during a normal year, it's going to be a few more.
Yeah, that is, wow. What kind of, walk me through the project. What are you going to be showcasing?
So this originally started out as a request for qualifications back in the early spring. And I have a gallery that represents me in Houston, and they pushed me to apply. So I put my name in the hat. And I think if I can remember rightly, it was 380 people that put their qualifications in.
Wow.
Then 30 artists were selected as finalists to create proposals for specific sites. There are 10 sites between Hobby and George Bush International. The city of Houston had a very large budget, and so they wanted to expand their public art collection in those sites. And then out of the 30 artists, three artists per site created a proposal. And my site was G50 Concourse, which is the West Concourse at Hobby Airport, which I'm really excited about because it's got a huge glass wall and it's facing west. So the light coming in as the sun sets is just going to be gorgeous. So the three committees were, to my understanding, and I can find out the exact committee structure, but there's the Airport System Art Collection Committee, there's the Houston Arts Alliance Committee, and then there's the City of Houston Committee.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's like going through the, like, America's Got Talent kind of
screens. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So do you get to create a piece specific for that area, or are you going to be displaying a work that they, did they like vet a piece and you at the same time?
No. So I proposed an installation of 30 inflated steel clouds, and it's going to be part of their permanent art collection.
Wow.
So it will be there as long as the City of Houston and the airport system wants it there. They
Wow.
will be the owners of that artwork. So
what does it mean to you to have this happen?
I'm still a little in shock. It's a nice progression in my own trajectory as an artist and as a faculty at Tech. I think it's another, something else I can pull back into the classroom as another venue of what we can do as artists. You know, I was on the University Public Art Collection for a long time, 9.5 years, and it was the best committee I've ever served on. I really enjoyed myself there. I'm kind of lament that I'm not on that committee anymore, but I saw the value of what the public art on our campus does, and it really made me think of how could I get my work into that realm. I like the public realm, especially when it's in a setting like the airport.
Yeah.
Because my work is whimsical and fun, and you know, airports can be quite stressful and transitional spaces. And so it seems like a really interesting place to show and create a piece for that environment.
You said you proposed the piece, so it'd be metal clouds. Is that your discipline, or you know, what would you say your inspired you to create the piece?
Well, it's a progression of a process that I kind of came across on my own when I first started at Tech in 2000, whereby and I've developed this process now over the last 20 years where I've inflated metal using compressed air when it's hot. So steel becomes very plastic and malleable when it's hot, maybe 1500, 1600 degrees Fahrenheit. Just like a blacksmith would take a hammer and change the shape of a bar of steel to maybe a horseshoe or a hinge, I thought and wondered if I could use air as a pressure to shape material that was welded into patterns. And so over the last 20 years, I've been developing this process and allowing it to inform my concepts and ideas. So it's treated me really well and keeps me engaged intellectually. So I'm very inspired by it. And so I took that and the inspiration of living up here on the Llano Estacado and the beautiful atmosphere and all of the clouds that we get to see. And it just seemed to be fitting. It was a very simple idea that fit well with the environment of the airport and the space of that installation site.
I'm glad you mentioned the Llano Estacado. It's it's this really strange. You really have to change your perspective to understand what you're standing on.
Oh yeah.
I think most people come here and they're like, "Oh, this is it," but you have no idea that you're on this thing, this really interesting geographical landmark.
Oh, most definitely. It's certainly plucked at my heartstrings over the years. I grew up in the north of England, and the North Wales was my playground, as well as the Pennines and the Yorkshire Moors and the Dales. And I've grown up to just appreciate the beauty of that type of environment. I've lived on the East Coast of the United States in Virginia and upstate New York, and I've enjoyed that, but nothing else has given me the experience that this huge flat plain that we live on at such a high altitude as well.
Yeah.
You know, it gives a different sense of time. You can see where you've come from. You see where you stand. You see where you could potentially go. The color in the atmosphere and the sky is very different. There's just nothing that impedes your view. I find it very engaging.
Like juxtaposing the two places, I would almost feel claustrophobic.
Oh, yes.
There as opposed to here, because I'm so used to now this, like you said, like being able to see for miles and just feeling like walking that horizon all the time where it just feels free.
Totally. Yeah. My wife Shannon is from Pittsburgh, PA, and we go visit, and if we're there for a couple of weeks, I really start to get homesick. And as you say, you feel claustrophobic. It's like, yeah. Oh no, something else blocking my view. It's just,
yeah. I mean, we have like, I don't even know the actual number of sunny days here.
It's crazy.
So when did you come upon being able to, or experimenting with, inflating metal? Like what you said in 2000, was that something that you brought with you or did you discover?
No, it's something I'd never seen before. It was very serendipitous. You know, I'm a studio artist and playing leads my practice. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big believer in play, especially as a creative person. And it's something I talk to my students about a lot, is trying to find that mode where you can play and be productive at the same time. I went to graduate school at Syracuse University, and I was there with a fellow Brit who made these lovely, big, soft, inflatable structures and sculptures made from latex. So he would buy liquid latex and roll it out over these gorgeous textures and then peel it up, sew them together, and put a fan to inflate them. And I really love the kind of the playfulness and the tactility that they offered. As a sculptor, I'm a maker. It's all about my hands. My hands engage my heart and my head. So these inflatable structures really kind of played on me a lot, but they were so ephemeral and people would pop them on purpose. And that really pissed me off. Because I come from a lineage of craftspeople that spend a lot of time developing their craft and making what they make. My dad's a master cabinet maker and a woodworker. So I grew up in a wood shop and on job sites in the 1970s. My mum's dad was a foundryman for the British Rails, and he worked for Rolls-Royce during the war. My other grandfather was a tool and die maker. His father was an art glass blower. So there's this great lineage in me that I don't like it when things get vandalized at that point. And I got hired at Tech in 2000 to teach welding, metal fabrication in the sculpture program to complement my colleague at the time, Sarah Waters. I also run a foundry myself. So I got a foundry up and running. We do a lot of lost wax casting and I teach kinetics. So, you know, things that move and make sounds. And I enjoy those kind of weird things. And it was right before Valentine's Day in 2001. And this thought came to me as I wonder if I could inflate steel like my friend Roger was inflating his latex patterns. And I just cut out two flat shapes in the form of a heart, welded the seam together, cut a little hole in it so I could weld a tube onto that. Then I heated it up with an oxyacetylene torch and force compressed air inside of it, and it worked. It was like, ooh. And it just really touched something inside of me, both in my intellect and in my making sensibility. And it's been a development of that point ever since. So,
as a sculptor, do you still follow that same sort of process of cutting out the, working the metal into the shape you want, or relative to the shape you want before heating it up? Or have you played with that metal when it is malleable and hot?
Oh, I've done both. I mean, generally it starts out where I will cut out what I would say describe as a two-dimensional pattern from a piece of sheet steel. And the steel is very thin. It's only 22 gauge. So it's about the thickness of the sheet metal on your car. Mm. And then I'll weld those together and create a manifold or a way to pump air into that pattern. And then when I get it hot and pump the air in, it turns from a two-dimensional pattern to a three-dimensional form. There are other times where I fabricate a form within itself. So it's three-dimensional, just flat and very cubic. Like if you cut a form out on the back of a cereal box and folded along the dotted lines and glued the little flaps together, yeah. I fabricate the steel like that sometimes, and then I'll put it in the kiln and inflate it. So there's many ways of me playing with this, and it still offers me a great range of research.
Yeah. Have you brought this, have you taught your students this process as well, or is it?
Well, that's a bit of a touchy line because I'm represented in three galleries. So this is somewhat my aesthetic within my work. Yeah. As a practicing studio artist. So, you know, it's like, I really can't do that because then they're making my work. So that doesn't feel right to me. I'm not trying to make little wills. I'm trying to let students have an environment where they can find their own artistic voice and artistic ideas. So I prefer just to keep teaching them processes that they can utilize and see how it affects the way it could dovetail into a different major. I get a lot of painters, photographers. I get a lot of engineers and architects in my classes. And I like that mix of diversity too. But to me, the class is to give them agency, not to teach them about my work. I certainly give them the stories of how I've gotten to where I've gotten. But
tell me what it's like to have an engineer in your class.
It's great because they take my classes because we're a lot looser within our structure than the engineering classes are. And it gives them a different lens and perspective to look at very similar processes. So there's a really good instance of it gives them the opportunity to play.
I'd have to imagine. My younger brother's an engineer, and he told me once that he was jealous of me because of, you know, the creativity. And he said, I'm just not a creative. I'm an engineer. Creativity doesn't really play into it because he's in a system of, you know, must like there's a lot of processes and a lot of manuals and a lot of standard operating procedures that he follows. I said, you know, Rob, any problem you're ever going to come to requires creativity.
Exactly.
So I bet the engineers get so much joy out of being able to just have a sort of freedom to do anything.
Yes. And likewise with the architects too, it lets them really experiment with materials in a way that they're not used to. And I hope that they feed that back into their own practices at some point. It's an avenue I'd really like to develop further, that relationship between architecture and engineering and the classes we offer over in sculpture. So,
yeah, that would be really exciting.
See, part of my process within this project is I have to talk with structural engineers and things of that nature. So for me, that puts me way out of my wheelhouse.
Yeah. That leads me to the question of how big is this going to be?
So each cloud, I'll just pick one up for you because I've got the models around.
Oh, wow.
So these are, there's one of the cloud forms. I don't know if you can see that. So these forms are 3 feet in width and 2 feet in height, and they're about 12 to 14 inches deep. And they only weigh a couple of pounds, which is great. So that gives me a lot of freedom. So there'll be, I've got three different designs of a cloud form, and there will be 10 of each. And they'll be finished in automotive finishes from a pearlescent white to pearlescent silver. So they really reflect the environment.
Oh, wow. So when that sun is setting, when you get golden hour
from
that window.
That's what I'm hoping for.
Yeah, that's going to be really unique. What's the timeline for the project itself?
So right now I'm waiting on schematics of the airport site. Obviously there's security issues around that. They couldn't just hand those out. So I'm supposed to receive those this week. I met with the City of Houston and the Houston Arts Alliance and the Airport System Art Collection last Friday. And so we had a great meeting. They have no worries about my sculpture, which was really nice to hear. The installation, they're very happy about. So we have to have the design finalized by the end of November. And that includes, you know, the exact locations of where each form will hang, how they will hang, how they'll be located, and then have a structural engineer stamp on there. And then once that's finalized, then funds will be released so that I can begin fabrication between January and April, and with an installation of late April or May.
That's
so wild. It's a lot of work really quickly.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking. This is kind of rapid pace.
Yeah, and plus the spring, I'm on a 2-3 teaching load. And of course, the spring is my 3 teaching load. So I'm in the process of begging my director for a course release so I can just have a bit more room to breathe and make this a lot more successful.
How many galleries are you featured in?
3.
3 galleries.
Yeah, I just had an opening in Dallas this past weekend at Chris Worley Fine Arts. I had a solo show there, and then I'm represented by Anya Tisch Gallery in Houston and Pan American Art Projects in Miami, Florida. So they keep me busy generally, pretty much year round, either with commissions or with solo exhibitions of new work. So
Miami, I mean, these are big cities you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
And you know, with a gallery, your audience is definitely people who love and appreciate art.
Yes.
So the airport, you're going to have lay people walking around. What does that do for you as an artist to know that? Or does it give you a different perspective of your work, or are you conscious of that at all?
Yeah, I'm very conscious of it. That excites me to have people of all walks of life looking at my work rather than educated or academics or other artists or collectors. So it's interesting. I mean, it's a shame I can't be there listening to people as they respond to the work, because that's interesting too, because art is subjective. Visual art is a subjective field. So you can't please everybody all the time. But, you know, I just, as I said earlier, my work is very whimsical and fun and playful. And I like to see how people respond to that.
That would be a very unique, social kind of
experience.
To just be like a fly on the wall as totally. People take this in.
Maybe I should put a hidden microphone in one of my clouds and it can connect to the internet and just send me conversations once in a while.
I'm sure we have a webcam floating around here somewhere. Yeah. Just, little button kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
There you go.
It'd be hilarious.
I'm curious because, you said 6.5 million people. And like you said, they're in different states of mind in the middle of travel. They've kind of been, I know every time I go to an airport, I feel like I've been accosted before I even get onto the flight, just because you have to go through, you're not sure if you have to take your shoes off anymore or, what state of undress you have to be in before you get through the security thing. And then you're fighting through people, looking at closures. I mean, it's a very unique state of mind that people are going to be in.
Yeah, very much so. The stress level is crazy.
Yeah. So you said whimsical. And did that inspire any of like the cloud formation in your mind?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. I was born in 1970. So I grew up in the 70s during, pretty much for me anyway, the heyday of pop art and things being very bright and colorful. And I think when you give access to art like that, all people can approach it and look at it. Whereas some works, you really do need to be very educated and in the know to even begin to understand it. And so, I come from very working class background. And for me, it's important that I offer something to all levels of education or all levels of walks of life so that they can access the work. It is important for me to have a little whimsy and fun there. When I go to airports, I'm stressed out like crazy too.
Yeah.
And normally when I'm flying internationally because I'm going to go home and see my parents.
Yeah.
And it's just nuts when it's normal. And now COVID and post-COVID, the knock-on effects of this pandemic are going to be with us for a long time. And I think that just adds that extra layer of, am I going to make my flight? And you rush to get to your gate and then you've got an hour to waste. And it's like, I see the value there of public art in airports because it just lets your mind wander and relax and take you out of the stress of that moment. So I think things that are fun and bright and colorful and reflective of the environment are very appropriate for those types of spaces.
Where do you start in the process? Do you start in the mind or do you start with your hands?
It vacillates between both areas. I've been watching a video from John Cleese about the creative process, and he talks about open and closed modes of creativity. And in the open mode, we generate all these fabulous ideas, but we don't make. We just dawdle and we're idle in that making process. But then we are in a closed mode of creativity and we make, but we're not necessarily thinking. And I kind of like working between those two areas. So there are times if I'm stuck, I'll just go to the studio and just start making stuff. And that generally informs me of my next step or will start to generate ideas. Then there are other times, very much like these cloud forms, where I've just been inspired by my environment and it's made me go into the studio to make those forms just to see what happens. So the two really work together. One is not more important than the other. The formal and the conceptual have an equal weight for me anyway.
Is there ever a moment you're not thinking about creation?
Yeah, when I'm out on a bicycle ride, I'm an avid cyclist. So it helps keep me fit. And, the stress of sometimes teaching or committee work or just daily life, family life. It's a time and a place where I can get out and I can ride my legs off and my mind just empties. And I'm in that moment where it's just more about the momentum of movement. And that's what I'm trying to find when I'm in the studio too. These creative fluid moments. So yeah, there are plenty of times where I think when we don't think so consciously, we can find new avenues of thought and new avenues of execution for ourselves.
That rhythm.